Father John A. Hardin, S.J., continues his series of conferences on vocation formation.
Training in self-mastery. Brother.
Yes. Training in self-mastery in doing things such as practical things, such as what St. Ignatius would recommend in the particular exam, marking down the faults. I presume that's what is meant here, and I don't know, maybe not.
Well, it means that plus. It means, of course, that first I know there are things in my life, in my personality, that need control. And that, for some people, would you believe it, is a lifetime discovery. You may have met, I know I have, men, women too, confirmed alcoholics who don't think they've got an alcohol problem. Did you know that? It seems the mind almost naturally blinds itself to the weaknesses of the will. So there's no point in talking about self-mastery to people who don't realize they've got something to master. And this is, by the way, where those in formation have a responsibility. You may not like to do it. You may wish to be on the other side of the world when you're called upon to do it. But you must call those under your care attention to their weaknesses, failings, and things that are not in control. Right? And don't talk in generalities. We're all naturally selfish. That's no help. I'm not saying you snoop around and watch or open the door a little bit when they're in the room and peek in to see how they're behaving. Common sense must protect you. But I would say part of this training in self-mastery on the part of the one who is directing souls is to be able to identify certain weaknesses of character in the concrete. Don't tell them they're selfish. She might just as well tell you, well, you are too, and she'd be right. We all have the weakness, or proud, or whatever. But no, you're selfish. I noticed the table. 3 days in a row, you chose the biggest portion. Well, I noticed somebody did a favor for you, and I watched. You didn't say thank you. Without overdoing it, remember that in the supernatural life, especially on the level of sanctity to which these people are being led, they are in their way, barring some exceptions that God may send you, in the infantile stage. Don't allow what may be their superior intelligence to deceive you, or their age, or their experience, which frankly may be superior to your own. But assume they are still tottering infants in the pursuit of sanctity. Now, if you're wrong, don't worry. If they're really that holy, they won't mind being treated as little children. And you will protect yourself from making all kinds of mistakes. Especially, can you imagine a mother never calling her child's attention to things that it does wrong? how would that child ever be trained? But you've got to know what you're talking about. If I could use the expression, you've got to be as aware of the least movement of those under your care as a mother is of her child. Does that make sense? You're dealing with adults. But the love you have should be that solicitous. Is that? Okay. Any other contributions? Shall I make mine then? Training in self-mastery. Make sure that those you are directing realize the need to master themselves. And this is where what all I've been saying so far comes into play. There are certain things you can publicly tell whoever is there that we all need, including yourself, mastery in certain things. The tendencies towards pride, towards envy, towards jealousy, towards going out to things that appeal to us, the dread of things that will pain. But then secondly, get specific. In other words, there are two forms of training in self-mastery. There's one that I would call public and the other private. In public, you can do just so much. But be sure the people you are helping are convinced that they've got weaknesses, failings, and that when they fail, something happens. Now, it might be that when a person fails, their conscience has been so sensitized that they instinctively realize they've done wrong. But don't bank on it. Help their conscience by telling them. Now, don't go around humiliating people. But most people find it hard to be corrected. I watched Mother Teresa, a professional in spiritual direction. Kind, gentle as they come. But she corrects. And by the way, on this level of private training and self-mastery, don't wait too long from the time that they've done something wrong to the time you call their attention to what they've done. We had a rector in Cincinnati. I was a scholastic then. We used to do this. Sometimes we wondered what he did in his spare time. There were some 40 men in the community, priests, scholastics, and brothers. In a given morning, there might be 10, 15, or 20 notes in our mailboxes. Praising us for what we've done well and calling our attention to something we've done wrong. I think I told you, didn't I, by the time that I tried to train the community in speaking more slowly and loudly in their prayers in chapel. Did I tell you this? I thought they were mumbling. So I was informed. He's the rector. He stuck with the community, not me. So that's the beginning, I would say. Self-mastery, realizing there are certain problems we've all got, certain weaknesses, and illustrate, by the way, be a good storyteller. I've had people fast asleep in what I thought was a profound theological lecture. I could tell the people to wake up, they wouldn't hear me. Now, this is mysterious. You start telling a story, And by some strange alchemy of the human psyche, they wake up. Tell stories, and by the way, watch yourself when you do it, but stories about yourself. And don't fear that you're going to, well, become vain or proud in the process, especially if they're the kind of stories that are self-humiliating. When you talk about other people's faults, be sure that you do not, unless it's absolutely necessary, in most cases it is not, identify the person. The problems that people had in overcoming themselves. We had a professor in theology who had a violent temper. Scholastics didn't want to serve his mass. They didn't know what was going to happen. He'd board you out in the middle of the mass. The amice, he'd wear the amice. If those strands didn't come out, he'd tear them off. But right after chewing you up, he'd be sorry. He'd apologize. In class, he'd throw books at us. I don't mean every day, but you never knew. And sometimes you thought you were asking an innocent question. But it couldn't have been innocent because you saw the book coming in your direction. Then he'd come to your room, rap at the door, and just be all apologies for losing his temper. I think the last letter he wrote before he died, he wrote to me on his deathbed. One reason among others that I'm doing what I'm doing and communicating the faith. He said, share it, communicate, no matter what it costs. Before he died, he became very mellow. It took 70 years to do it. Each person then, as we've been saying, should know their own particular and peculiar sinful tendencies. People differ as persons. They differ at different times. They also have different tendencies, not only because of, say, the time of the day, but people change. And one of the hardest things that young people have told me is that they've honestly believed that they have reformed in some one thing. And now I suppose men and women don't differ too much here. And here, this is quotation, that women tend to have longer lasting memories than men. So this training in self-mastery, don't just keep hammering away at the fault, which they may still have some of, but watch progress, the least improvement. Now, don't overdo it so they don't get swell-headed and then think they've got it under control. Finally, I would like to say something about the four temperaments. Did we talk about this already in this class? But I suppose in some context somewhere I have. They were first discovered, or at least philosophically distinguished, by Aristotle, 4th century B.C. They were adopted by St. Thomas and the Church, simply assumed. You can classify people within broad ranges. There are four classic temperaments, and it's well to know the kind of person you're dealing with. There's the sanguine, the choleric, the lethargic, and the melancholic. Training in self-mastery is in large measure dependent on the kind of temperament the person has. Because without their telling you all about themselves, you can tell them a lot before they even talk to you. If they are the sanguine temperament, they tend to be optimistic. Everything is fine. If other people have problems, they seem never to have them. They wonder sometimes why Christ should have made such a stress on the cross. The cross, what's that? The word spelled C-R-O-S-S. There is a certain amount of this, I suppose, in most of us, but some have more of it than others. What is the besetting weakness of this type of person? They tend to be thoughtless. Those who want to be really unkind, they call them harebrained. How is hair spelled in that word, harebrained?
H-A-R-E.
Hair being a what? Rabbit. Rabbit brain. One of the smallest brains, I'm told, known to zoology, is the brain of a rabbit. Thoughtless people. To think before they act. The choleric. They are, of course, the irascible type. They tend to react in a flash and generally negatively. They must be, first of all, told to stop it. And I'm told, as with the alcoholism, people with this kind of a temper, in fact, we practically identify temper with this temperament, they can be a real liability in a community, and if the worst comes to the worst, they must be told, either you get control of yourself, or we will have to ask you to leave. And it must be under control sufficiently by the time they take their first vows. Otherwise, these things flare up. And you, I'm sure you know, if you don't, let me tell you, there are some horrendous experiences. When I came to teach at the State University, Western Michigan, Kalamazoo, Michigan, I paid my respects the very next day to the local parish, St. Augustine's. The last thing I expected when I came there and talking to the pastor was to tell me that this parish has a reputation, because some years before, and nobody has forgotten it, one of the assistants, in a fit of anger, shot and killed the pastor. And the assistant is still serving lifetime sentence in Lansing Prison. I say that to accent, not that that will happen, but characters can be murdered. Do you believe that? Reputations can be ruined because somebody in a fit of anger says or does something that can never be undone. Permanent damage. So in dealing with this type of temperament, they must be told this cannot be tolerated. But of course, the temper will be there. Gentleness and kindness is a sovereign remedy for dealing with all kinds of people. But let me tell you, in dealing with people with a choleric temperament, you must be firm. Kind, yes, but firm. Because I've watched it by now, and I've got too many souls that have told me about their weaknesses in this matter. They tell me there are some people they wouldn't dare lose their temper with. Do you hear that? Don't give them a chance. Third, the lethargic. The, of course, the easygoing type. They're the ones who may get up late for the Golden Jubilee Mass. Not because they're up in years, but because over the years, they have never got into the habit of getting up on time. It's an addiction, the bed. They're just addicted to the bed, that's all. And anything soft and easy. Now it's here especially that Ignatius' rule, Agere Contra, is so valuable. To be told to consciously choose that which is less convenient, less soft, to overcome their laziness, which is of course their besetting sin, by doing things they don't have to do. But why? Just to do them. I read years ago in a psychiatrist on how to train the will. I'm not recommending this, I'm just quoting this from a psychiatrist's book. He said, if you want to train yourself in, well, self-mastery, take several sheets of paper and cut them up into very small pieces and fill a box. Depending on how much self-mastery you want to cultivate, get a bigger box. Several hundred little pieces. You know from the size of the sheet how many pieces are there. Say, 50 to a page. By 10 pages, it's 500 pieces. Then, I'm still quoting, you got them all in the box, then, and be sure it's a large room with furniture around. Scatter those 500 little pieces all over the room. Then get down on your knees and don't stop until you've picked up 500. That's a psychiatrist's recommendation for self-mastery. All right? Now, we don't have to scatter little pieces of paper in the room. Community life. Agreed? Don't make religious life too easy. Watch it. Watch it. Communities are raising generations of spoiled religious. And just because, by and large, we've got things, what do we need? Tell me, what do we need in the religious life? Food, clothing, atmosphere, company. One of my friends, when I entered the Jesuits from college, said, John, I envy you. For the rest of a life, you will be among your intellectual peers. Well, little did he know. But it's true. There are many blessings in the religious life. But for that very reason, don't spoil it for human nature. I cannot overemphasize this. The finest of this and the best of that. In plain Anglo-Saxon, it's silly. No wonder at the first trial they're thrown for a loss. Sometimes I'm afraid religious life is an artificial life. the average husband and wife in a family. I wish I could get a book. I forget even who the author was. It was a mother. Was it a mother? No. Mother and father. I read it when I gave a retreat in Connecticut. And it was how to raise children, but it was just a delightful one story after another. From, say, 5:30 in the morning, when somebody gets up before they're supposed to, until the children are sent off to school. What happened? Everything happens. Seems nothing goes right. The religious life can be so soft cushioned, so padded, so protected, so insulated, that then we wonder, why did we create such softies in communities?
Please turn over to side B and push the play button immediately without rewinding the tape.